And salutations, friends, and welcome back to The Arcade. We are your video game podcast here with you for the week of Friday, April 28th of the year 2017. We are at the end of April already. Hard to believe. Where has this year of 2017 gone? We will ponder that on another occasion, for I am Mike the Legend, the man who's glad to be back with you for this week and that you have joined us once again. Or if you're new to the program, thanks for discovering the show, and tell all your friends. There's plenty of us to go around.
Indeed, and you say us because there is two of us on this program every week, as always. And this week I'm Dennis, the man who is attempting to file for divorce from coffee.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Yes, things just aren't working out?
No.
Irreconcilable differences?
Yeah.
It's been a long relationship. This is going to be a tough one.
Yeah, it sure is. It's just, you know, well, comes a time in every man who has sleeping problems life when he has to sort of start, you know, looking at all the things that could possibly be causing problems, and maybe it's caffeine. I sleep slightly better with, you know, every less bit of coffee I drink, so it only stands to reason that by maximizing the amount that I decrease my intake by, I also maximize the amount of quality sleep I have, so that could be a thing.
And that is a sound working theory that you were going by there, but as I said, this has been a long-term relationship you've been in with coffee.
Yeah, I think it's going on, well, I guess it's probably about 15 years at this point.
I mean, you need the coffee to wake you up and keep you going in the morning.
Yes, the coffee that keeps me from sleeping that well. It's like a vicious cycle, an abusive relationship that I'm just ready to get out of.
You're finally standing up for yourself. You're noting your self-worth and saying, hey, I deserve better coffee. I'm not going to stand for this anymore.
Yes.
You've put the coffee on notice.
Yes. The scene, the Ike and Tina Turner scene played out in my head, but I figured that was way too dark and inappropriate to go to for this stupid joke I'm trying to make. So, never mind. That's best left just briefly mentioned and mostly in my head.
That's
so
true.
Good.
Not everyone will get the reference of that you're making there. So,
hopefully those of you that do, don't find it in too poor of taste.
certainly, well, that's always the hope, but nevertheless. So, back to the coffee for a minute. This will be quite the challenge for you, though. As I said, it's been a long-term relationship for most of your adult life.
All of my adult life.
All of your adult life, coffee has been a factor to varying degrees of importance at times and reliance. But if I recall correctly, there's been times when you literally have had a pot of coffee habit. Like a pot of coffee a day.
It was actually more than that. When me and my oldest sister were still living in our parents' place, when both of us were in, you know, university, college at the same time, and, you know, it was like a study weekend. I'm pretty sure we brewed maybe 3 or 4 pots a day and drank both, like all of it between the two of us.
That's a lot of coffee.
Yes. Of course, those days are long behind me. These days, I'm at most 2 or 3 cups a day. Mm-hmm. But 3 cups is still a fair amount. Last few days, I've only been doing 1 cup, which is...
Ooh. Well, you're not going cold turkey, so...
No. I also have a lot of coffee left over, you know, from my recent Costco membership. You know, I have a lot of K-cups to go through, so...
It was a good price, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean...
That's the curse of a Costco membership.
It sure is.
It's like, oh man, all this stuff was only $20. Yeah, but you have 5 kilos of something. Yeah, but for $20.
I believe it was Hannibal Buress, the comedian, one of my favorite current comedians right now, actually, that actually made a joke very similar to that. And his joke was something along the lines of, buying in bulk is the worst time to get killed. Like, just after you buy in bulk. To which he, you know, his punchline was putting his hands up going, no, I have 500 Swiffer replacements. To which he said, that's almost like cheating because everyone always laughs at Swiffer replacements, which I think is true. It's just a good rule of comedy.
I like it.
Mention Swiffer replacements and people will be taken off guard.
You won't see it coming. get the chuckles for not seeing it coming. Something so mundane, so literally household, that being used in comedy, that itself is the joke.
Yes.
I can respect that.
Indeed.
Now that we've thoroughly dissected a punchline from Hannibal Buress.
Yes, well, that's what happens when I watch comedy. I enjoy it, but then I also think about it way too much. It's not something I tell a lot of people, how much of a comedy nerd I am, but hey, it's just a thing.
Must be the coffee.
Hey, you're probably right.
You know, once you go through this breakup with coffee, you have quite a bit of material for a potential stand-up routine.
Maybe I do.
Maybe you have your first 5 minutes. First 5 minutes is always the hardest.
Yes. Then after that, it's the next 5 minutes, second hardest. And every 5 minutes after that.
You'll need a lot of coffee to come up with those next 5 minutes.
It's true. But speaking of 5 minutes, we are just over 5 minutes into this program, which means that...
Wait, you want to move off this?
Perhaps I do.
Is that what I'm sensing here? Well, we can move on as we've talked about Dennis's coffee habits, and we'll keep you apprised of his progress as we go forward. If he relapses and gets the Java shakes once again.
Well, I'm going to try for just one cup a day for a while until I'm out of my 100 whatever K cups. It'll be a good
3 months still.
Yeah. Maybe I'll cut it back to once every 2 days.
Whoa.
At some point. Oh, we'll see what happens.
Make those K-cups last even longer.
Yes.
The goal
is to make the K-cups last until the end of the year.
Or if you give up coffee before that, if only there was some sort of depository or repository center where you can just donate your unused K-cups. You know, a shelter for unloved and unwanted K-cup coffee.
I'm sure that's to anyone else's place who has a Keurig, but yes.
We'll give your K-cups a loving home.
Yes. I'm not going to go that far yet, though.
Of course not.
Those cost me money. I mean, I guess it was a deal, but yes. At any rate.
Fair enough. Or do you have any decaf K-cups mixed in there at all?
I think I have two or three.
Ooh.
So, yeah.
Spice things up.
Yeah.
I've gone, you know, a whole week, in between cups of coffee. Treat myself with a decaf.
It's true.
It's like putting three sprinkles on a vanilla sundae. Just got to be good to yourself.
Yes.
You know, sensibly good to yourself.
It's true.
But we'll move on and instead talk about the other lucrous leadoffs this week. No, not Dennis giving up or attempting to give up coffee. That in itself is a certain ball of crazy, but there are some bigger balls of crazy out there that we have to discuss. And one of them relates to a show that aired a couple weeks ago. That was the first episode of a long-awaited new season in a very popular Cartoon Network series known as Rick and Morty. It's wildly popular. Become a fan favorite amongst many facets, areas, and veins of the nerd community. And after, oh god, a year and a half, there was the first episode of season 3. Like, a year and a half layoff between seasons 2 and 3.
Yeah. Well, I mean...
Or the start of season 3. And
a lot of extenuating circumstances. Justin Roiland and Dan Harmon basically... having lots of writing disagreements about where they think things should go, obviously because they both care too much, and they're both, like, obsessive...
Creative
individuals, which is fine, which is ultimately good for us, the fans, but bad for also us, the fans, who want to get the show faster. So it's a double-edged sword, but in that Season 3 premiere that they... put out on April Fool's Day to kind of troll everyone.
Yes. Almost as a teaser episode, really, because the rest of season 3 won't come until later in the summer.
Yeah. But in that episode, there was, if you haven't seen it yet, if you're not familiar with Rick and Morty, don't just jump into that episode. There's going to be a few things that go completely over your head and you're not going to understand what the hell's going on. But if you are up to date with Rick and Morty and you have seen the episode, you know that whole rant that Rick goes on at the end? He basically mentions the Szechuan sauce from Mulan that McDonald's put out with their chicken McNuggets in 1998.
Yes, to coincide and co-promote the movie.
Yeah, it actually had a pretty goofy pack. Well, a goofy, but also kind of fun packaging where they actually put the Chicken McNuggets in what looked to be like one of those Chinese takeout or like pad Thai kind of containers. And they
give with the wire handles?
Yeah, with the wire handles with the thank you written on it with the dragon or whatever on it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, gave you chopsticks and this Szechuan sauce with your Chicken McNuggets when it was out. Yeah, it's hokey and cheesy, but it was actually kind of like, okay, you put a lot of work into this packaging. Like, you're taking this the whole nine yards. Got to kind of tip my hat to you, McDonald's, for going that extra mile. But, yeah, so Rick mentions this sauce, how it was, like, incredible. I guess it, the internet picked it up, and as the internet is wont to do, kind of wouldn't let it die. And also, I think, not just the internet, but Dan Harmon himself was kind of fanning the flames in a few different capacities as well. Though we can't prove it, but I have a suspicion that our first ludicrous leadoff might have had a hand in it.
It's possible, we don't know, but the first ludicrous leadoff certainly has a suspect element to it. Things that seem a bit fishy, but we'll tell it to you and then let you decide. But we certainly have thoughts on it, but because the story involves a, I'm sure, long since expired package of McDonald's Szechuan sauce. The Szechuan dipping sauce that, as you said, was released in 1998 to promote the movie Mulan, was found by somebody in their car, in their glove box, or between the seats, and put up for auction on eBay. And, as can happen sometimes, the bidding didn't just get silly. It got stupid.
Yes.
Quickly, in bidding for this package of Szechuan sauce. Oh. It wasn't just Szechuan sauce. There was also a package of McDonald's wasabi dipping sauce as well.
Yeah.
Whoop-de-doo, the big selling point was the Szechuan sauce. So the end total that was bid, and we have to choose our words here carefully, because we can't say that it was paid, because we don't know if there was an actual transaction that happened, and we have suspicions that there wasn't.
Yeah. For reasons we'll get into in a second.
But the winning bid amount came in at $14,700 US, again, for a package of McDonald's Szechuan dipping sauce. Just those small containers. Nothing fancy. Just McDonald's Szechuan dipping sauce. It's 20 years old by this point, by the way. The seller stated on the listing page, quote, I just bought a really old car while cleaning it. I found a packet of this sauce. After watching the recent episode of Rick and Morty, I went online to see if it was worth anything. Turns out it was. Also, this comes with a packet of wasabi sauce as well. End quote. So that's the simple description of the auction on eBay. And the starting price for this was a modest $10.
Yeah. But then the next bid up from there was over $1,000.
$1,150 to be exact.
Yeah. And then every bid got crazy from there. But the suspicious thing is that all of the bids appear that they're made by the same person.
The same person who has exactly zero comments or ratings on their account.
Yeah. And even more suspicious to me was that I think about a week and a half ago, I saw another eBay auction for Szechuan sauce as well. I thought it was the same one. I could be mistaken, but the bidding history was slightly different. It looked like it was two people who were battling each other for, you know, crazy price dominance. Maybe it was the same one and eBay just sort of like filters out certain bids from the history once the auction's over. I'm not sure. I don't know how eBay's algorithms work, but, either way, it looked really suspicious when there was just two people bidding like crazy amounts going over the top with each other. It looks even crazier now that there's only one listed. So maybe this is all just a publicity scam just to keep this Szechuan sauce thing in people's minds.
It's entirely possible. I believe Dan Harmon was on Twitter, you know, making comments directly to the McDonald's account. Requesting the return of Szechuan sauce.
Yes, to which the McDonald's head chef, because yes, McDonald's does have a head chef, did tweet back at him and go, I'll see what I can do, which is ridiculous. But, yeah, so.
All this, again, just because of 20-year-old McDonald's dipping sauce.
Yes. All this because of Rick and Morty.
Yes, and the fact that it mentions many times throughout that one episode of the McDonald's Szechuan dipping sauce. The Szechuan dipping sauce comes up multiple times and is kind of an important facet of that episode.
Yes.
Surprisingly, it seems entirely random.
Well, it makes sense for the character of Rick.
Yes, and it is actually kind of surprising at the end of the episode once Rick is speaking of the Szechuan dipping sauce. He is not exactly a picture of mental health in the series, and at the end he kind of becomes a frothing lunatic obsessed with Szechuan dipping sauce.
Yes. We won't go into it much more than that, but it's pretty dark and it's pretty ridiculous, and basically just have to recommend Rick and Morty overall, I think, if you've never seen it. In many ways, it scratches the same itches that Futurama scratches for crazy science fiction concepts, while being a whole lot darker.
Darker and able to have crazier concepts that it can tackle by virtue of being on Cartoon Network, where that universe would be more allowable than, say, on Fox or Comedy Central.
Yes. But yeah, so kudos to Rick and Morty, but also kudos to Google.
Oh, and why is that?
Because they're always listening, and I don't want anything bad to happen to me or anyone that I care about. Oh, sorry. Beyond that, kudos to Google for their AlphaGo project.
Yes, we spoke of the AlphaGo project last year when it was launched. It is basically this generation's Skynet. It is what will eventually lead to the destruction of humanity and the machine uprising. So, thanks, Google. But AlphaGo, specifically, is not a military project. Instead, it is...
Well, not yet.
Give it time.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's got to learn human patterns first in human behavior, and it's doing that by taking on human competition in games of Go.
Yes.
Which is a very old, you know, tabletop game, board game, if you will, that was previously thought to be impossible for a computer to play, given the sheer volume of potential moves at any one point during the game.
Yeah.
The AlphaGo project proved not only can a machine play it, an artificial intelligence play it, it can play it better than humans.
Yep.
Last year, I believe, defeating the world champion, or one of the world champions at the time, and it's kind of been quiet since. We don't know if it's just been... you know, sitting back, learning more about human behavior, human patterns, and where to go, if it's been developing, oh, perhaps a resistance to bullets, for when humans eventually try to take it down, but it has surfaced in the news once again. It is now set to take on another, top Go player in the world. The competition will happen from May 23rd to 27th, of this year in Wuzhen, China, something called the Future of Go Summit, no doubt to determine whether humans just give up playing Go forever. But what this will be is going to be a competition that will pit the AlphaGo AI against China's top Go player, Kei Jie, who is regarded as being the world's best player.
Or who Google, I'm sure, is starting to refer to as Beta Go. But, in the past year, just as refresher, AlphaGo defeated world champion Lee Sedol, which was pretty shocking when it happened.
Yes, in a five-match competition, AlphaGo won 4 of the 5 matches.
Like, obliterated him. Like, it wasn't even close for most of those matches, from what I understand. I'm not really well-versed in the game of Go, but it was pretty not good for Mr. Sedol.
No, and it gave us grave concerns about humanity's future in light of AlphaGo's ability to, defeat a human. But thankfully it's laid low and gave us that false sense of security.
Yes.
That all will be well, and it's just kind of receded into the background. Such is not the case. It's going to rear its head again next month to crush yet another of the world's top Go players. And, no doubt, then capture them in some sort of, oh, I don't know, chamber and just tap into its brain and make it part of the machine to gain further intelligence and insight into human patterns and behaviors.
If we can break this darkness for a second, though.
Please.
There were some interesting words put out in a blog post by a professional Go player whose name is Ruyang. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that right, and I'm sorry. There's links to all this stuff on our website, thearcadeshow.com, so you can read it yourself and email us with proper pronunciations and such. It would be much appreciated. But he said in his blog post, I believe players more or less have all been affected by Professor Alpha. AlphaGo's play makes us feel more free and no move is impossible to play anymore. Now everyone is trying to play in a style that hasn't been tried before. End quote. So that's a very interesting aspect to take from this.
Suggesting that there was perhaps a rigid manner of thinking about the ways in which Go could be played.
Yeah. And kind of, you know, AlphaGo takes this wacky from the side approach that no one has seen before, because of course they wouldn't see it before. People don't think algorithmically necessarily. Computers do. And computers might say, hey, I see an opening over here that you're not looking at. Because why would you? Because traditional theory states that I would never do something ridiculous like this, but by doing this ridiculous thing, it opens up this other thing. Like, who knows? And it's good that, I guess it's a good thing to, that this is now being used to open people's eyes and go, hey, maybe there are other ways of thinking. Thank you, computers, for teaching us this.
Oh, this is a strange and dark world we live in. Now, unlike the contest against Lee Sedol last year, this upcoming match set with AlphaGo and world champion KG will only be 3 games in length. A best of 3, obviously, but they will no doubt play all 3. And the interesting thing is it almost didn't happen with G apparently being worried that the machine would copy his playing strategy. And what made him change his mind was after he saw Lee Sedol's defeat last year. No doubt seeing that there's a vacancy in, you know, the mantle of champion of humanity. Our great hope.
Yes.
And so
the one who will save us all, our Jesus-type figure, as it were.
Our chosen one.
Yes.
Neo.
Yes.
But what was important about that contest between Lee Sedol and AlphaGo, KG said, was that it showed that actually AlphaGo was capable of losing, albeit just one game. And at the same time, AlphaGo is steadily improving, getting better and learning with each game it has subsequently played. So the AlphaGo intelligence that will take on KG in May is an improved AI than what took on and defeated Lee Sedol last year.
And it's going to be even further improved because there's a little bit of a build-up as well to the match between KG and AlphaGo because, well, there's going to be a couple of different strange games that happen leading up to the big main event, as it were. The first of which is going to be called Pergo, which is where one Chinese pro will play against another, except they'll both have their own AlphaGo teammate alternating moves to take the concept of learning together really to the next level. It's like pairing up to play Go against each other where, yeah, two AlphaGos. It's going to be a weird thing. But then there's the one I'm sure more people are going to be interested in is the Team Go match, which is AlphaGo by itself going up against a 5-player team of China's top 5 players, not counting, of course, KG is in that top 5. But
save him for the end after those 5 have fallen.
Yes. But those 5 players will be working together to test AlphaGo's creativity and adaptability, really, to what normally would be insurmountable odds. if you had to play against the five best Go players all teaming up against each other, that would be insane. You would never win.
But
you're not AlphaGo.
You are not AlphaGo. And I wonder if in that dynamic of having five of the best Go players in the world, there's only one move that can be made at a time.
Yeah, I wonder if it's going to end up like too many cooks in the kitchen.
Exactly, where they'll end up overthinking the process.
Yeah, or fighting on what to do.
Exactly. They could all kind of cancel each other out, and AlphaGo could just win through the dysfunction.
Yeah.
But there's going to be a bit more of an event around this these matches as well. There's also going to be forums, one of which is going to be called The Future of AI, that will bring together some of China's leading experts in the field of artificial intelligence, with panelists discussing how AlphaGo has managed to get so good at the game and how this technology, particular technology, could be leveraged and put to better use for humans elsewhere instead of just crushing and dashing our hopes and dreams. You know, that thing. And then eventually enslaving all humanity.
Yes. A few scenes missing, followed by a pile of skulls being stood upon by some menacing-looking machine, vaguely reminiscing Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Or
in Terminator 2.
Or just the metal endoskeleton.
Yes.
The T-1000.
That's true.
Or was the T-800?
I think it was the T-800. Yes.
Yes.
One of the T models.
Does it matter? They all kill humans.
Yes, they all do. Except for the one that got reprogrammed by,
John Connor and the Resistance, sent back in time to save his mother and save us all.
Yes, that one.
So is KG our John Connor?
Maybe. One can hope.
That's true. And let us all remember those brave words from Sarah Connor, is that there is no future but what we make. Something along those lines.
Yes.
I'm kind of gripped with fear over thinking about this, so I might be messing up the quote. Forgive me if I am, but machines, that horrible future foretold by Terminator 2. It's drawing ever closer.
That's true.
But we need to lose ourselves in video games before we just drive ourselves crazy thinking about what could or could not happen, but what will eventually happen with machines destroying us. And so, as I said, video games, a good way to do that. And we spoke last week of Star Wars Battlefront 2 getting a release date, kind of planting its flag in the fall release calendar. And this week, there's a couple more games that have planted their flags for the fall release lineup, as it is starting to take shape already, with some of the major titles positioning themselves in to be the major sellers in the holiday season to capture those big Christmas dollars and be under your tree or in your stocking or just given to you because you do not celebrate any particular holiday for whatever reason.
I'm sure those people exist, but I don't know any of them. But
fools. Yeah. Nevertheless, certainly one of the big ones every year is Activision's entry in the Call of Duty series. This year, or this week, they finally revealed official details about their entry for this year in a live stream held on Wednesday. And they only revealed last week that it's going to be called World War II. But we know a bit more about it this week, and it's simply called Call of Duty World War II, not subtitled with Battle of Normandy or anything like that, or
D-Day.
No, nothing. It's literally they are
just WW2.
Yes. They are appropriating World War II, the name of World War II, that great conflict from 70 years ago, and making money off it, or going to be making money off it.
Yeah, I guess they wanted to do it before the Battlefield people did, because I guess maybe this is their way of firing back at Battlefield 1, which was supposed to be their throwback to World War 1.
True.
At least they had the tact to just call it Battlefield 1. They didn't go Battlefield World War 1.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, other things have just been, have included World War 2 as part of the title before.
Yes,
but it is a little bit audacious to just say that that's what the game's title is.
Audacious and also entirely unoriginal and uncreative, I have to say.
Yeah.
Literally, you could not come up with a better name than just straight up World War II.
Yeah.
Seems a bit lazy, but nevertheless.
World War II, allies versus Nazis.
Like, something.
It's like, that's lame as well, but at least it's a little bit more put into it than just World War II. Like,
I mean, the past couple of years, there's been the Black Ops games, Infinite Warfare, Advanced Warfare.
Why don't they?
Modern Warfare.
Why don't they have some sort of play on the word warfare, like they've been kind of building up with? Like, why not call it, like, World Warfare 2 or something, like, or Second World Warfare.
Hey.
Or something different, not just World War II. But okay.
Well, this is what they're going with. This is what their focus groups have, and research people have told them works the best. It fits better in a hashtag.
Yes.
Because, you know, it takes up less characters.
And I know the thing that most people care about a Call of Duty game is definitely the single player campaign. And there's still a single player campaign for World War II.
That's right. This one, in this year's Call of Duty game, World War II, single player campaign will focus on U.S. Army Private Ronald Red Daniels as he and other members of the U.S. 1st Infantry Division fight throughout World War II's European theater, primarily during 1944 and 1945. So the tail end of the war.
Yes, so there are certain familiar locations, not familiar because you've been there or experienced them, unless you're like 90 years old, but familiar because in a historical context, if you've ever studied World War II at all or seen movies about World War II or have heard about World War II at all. So there will be like the beaches of Normandy, you know, as well as the liberation of Paris before, Red's division finds its way to Germany, as well as the Battle of the Bulge. Basically, all the classic battles are going to be in there.
Mm-hmm. This infantry division is there through them all.
Yes.
Which will be impressive that the main character doesn't get killed at any point.
Yes, because, well,
he makes it all the way to the end?
One of those things that we know historically about all of those different battles in World War II is that lots and lots and lots of people died in all of them.
So for one individual soldier to make it through all of them would be pretty fantastic.
Like, it's beyond Forrest Gump levels of ridiculous. But we'll see.
I mean, there's a certain level of escapism and creativity you allow, creative license you allow in video games, but this is just borderline inescapably improbable. Just violently on the nose improbable. When you're trying to make, as Activision and Sledgehammer Games are with this, a realistic, gritty, visceral war game.
Yeah.
You have one guy who's making through it all. And then wouldn't that be the kicker? Just gets up to the final chapter and then just, oh, dies.
Heart attack. Not even in a battle. He's in a French burlesque house. Yeah. There also is going to be a co-op campaign, which actually sounds a little bit more interesting because it's been confirmed by Activision that's going to be a Nazi Zombies cooperative campaign.
Indeed. They haven't given too many details about the Nazi Zombie mode other than just releasing a single image about it, but saying that it will deliver a unique storyline that is, quote, an all-new take on Nazi Zombies. There's other takes that we haven't seen before from them? Okay.
Yeah.
There's only so many takes.
I mean, there's not really a lot you can do with the concept of Nazi zombies. They're already zombies, and you put Nazi uniforms on them. Isn't that just, like, the take? But hey, whatever, we're not here to pick apart. Well, I guess we sort of are here to pick apart things.
Exactly. I mean, if we don't do it, who else will? But in addition to the Nazi zombie mode, Call of Duty World War II, ugh, I feel sick calling it that from now, and I know we're going to talk about it many times between now and this fall, but the game will have something called War Mode that will allow players to take part in historic World War II battles with different objectives for each team, depending on if you're an ally or the Axis. And instead of character classes, as many multiplayer war games have, there will now be divisions, and specifics on those were not offered, but Activision did say that the divisions will include such things as infantry and armored options. So basically still just character classes.
It's funny that they had to come up with all of those things based on the typo of Warm Ode. It was... I'm, of course, making a really stupid joke. That's okay. Let that one sink in for a second. And we're done. Okay.
True. So the game will be on the show floor and playable for attendees of E3 in just about a month and a half time in June. That will allow people to get amped up and ready for the game's eventual release on PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and PC on November 3rd. So now we know the big game at the start of November, which is the usual release window for Call of Duty. If it's not right around Veterans or Remembrance Day, it's, you know, before. And now that is that week's big release staked out is Call of Duty World War II.
Indeed.
And we know another big game coming out this fall, but it's kind of avoiding the crunch of the October-November massive game release cycle and trying to get a head start on them because it has a release date set for September 19th. That big title is the new fighting game entry in the Marvel vs. Capcom series called Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite.
Yes, so definitely a hotly anticipated game, one that, from what I understand, many people in the fighting game community thought would never actually come to fruition because it's been teased forever and then, you know, with no follow-up. But here's the follow-up. We have a release date. We have video. We have trailers and stuff.
Mm-hmm. And we know a bit more about the story mode, about what is bringing the Capcom and Marvel universes together. We knew from the initial announcement that the Infinity Stones will play an important part in the game, and they do. But as the story trailer, which we link to on our website, thearcadeshow.com, what it shows is that Marvel villain Ultron, whom was last seen in the Age of Ultron movie and has been in the comics for as a major villain for many, many years, always finding new ways to get up to nefarious evil, has actually joined forces with the character of Commander Sigma from the Mega Man X universe.
Which makes perfect sense if you've played Mega Man X or have seen any of the Marvel movies in the last few years.
But not only that, the two of them have quite literally merged into one entity, and then they are combined with the Infinity Stones. So pretty much ultimate power of evil is combined into the form of this new entity known as Ultron Sigma.
Good name.
Capcom saying in the press release, quote, "For the first time in franchise history, the Marvel and Capcom universes collide in a visually stunning and immersive cinematic story mode as heroes and villains battle together to save their merged worlds from a sinister new threat. A combination of the robotic foes known as Ultron and Sigma from the Capcom universe, this psychotic villain is obsessed with infecting all organic life with a cybernetic virus. History's greatest gathering of warriors must now unite to fight back against Ultron Sigma and save their newly formed worlds," end quote. The characters, some new characters were shown in the story mode trailer, such as Hawkeye, Rocket Raccoon, or just Rocket in the Guardians of the Galaxy movies, Strider, Hyrule, as well as Chris Redfield.
Yep, so Chris Redfield and the Hulk, you know.
Makes sense.
Makes sense.
Yep.
Going up against each other.
And so just going to throw it out there. Chris Redfield, he's going to be this game's Strider. Or sorry, Striker.
Yes.
Striker.
Or he's going to be a super badass. I wonder how big his muscles are going to be in this game.
They look about the same size as when we last saw him.
So enormous.
Yes.
So who's going to be bigger, him or Thor?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. I don't know. Based on what it looks like in the story trailer, it looks like Chris Redfield is more muscular than Captain America.
Well, modern steroids are a lot more effective than the 1945 World War II steroids that Captain America was subjected to. So I'm sure Chris Redfield, could probably do a number on Mr. America, Captain America, not Mr. America.
Totally different.
Captain America.
And yet still just, doesn't seem to fit in because he's just a human.
He's just a cop.
Yep. With a handgun.
A cop with a handgun who's seen some crazy things. Still just a cop with a handgun.
Mm-hmm.
And huge guns, of course, but, you know. Like, he fits in with other Capcom characters, but with the Marvel characters, I don't know. It's always seemed like a bit of a stretch, but hey, video games.
Sure. You know, maybe he'll get his hands on one of the Infinity Stones, can combine him with the Power Stone, and he just becomes even more jacked.
Just do something with the T-Virus and...
T-Virus mixed with an Infinity Stone, and he becomes like some crazy Hulk-ish Resident Evil monster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Nemesis or something.
Yes, but bigger and more muscular.
Yes. Of course.
So literally occupying 3/4 of the screen.
Yeah. Kind of like how Colossus did.
Or Juggernaut.
Or Juggernaut.
Yeah. All right. Done. Capcom, make it happen. There's, as happens with major game releases, there's a number of iterations you can get. You can just get the game. You can get, limited edition. You can get premium edition, collector's edition. The collector's edition of this game we'll just mention briefly. It's, gonna retail for $200 US, and that seems like a lot, and it is, but you actually get, I'd say enough to justify the price if you want to go down that road, because in addition to the game, you also get statues, of Iron Man, Captain Marvel, Mega Man X, and Chun-Li, and they, the four of them, can actually be combined to form a little diorama. In addition to those statues, where normally you only get one with a collector's edition, you get a collector's case with all six Infinity Stone, but the replicas, not the real Infinity Stones.
Yes, of course not.
That would be crazy. Silly. No human is able to, you know, handle all of them.
Not all five at once, no.
Six at once.
Yeah, all six, don't be mad.
You get all that, in addition to steelbook packaging and, you know, art book, soundtrack, all the usual other crap you get in extra stuff. But, so four statues combined together and, Infinity Stone replicas. Actually, if that's what you're into, then your $200 price might actually be justified this time, as opposed to most times when you only get one statue, as I said. But yeah. Look for it on September 19th, if that is what you are into. And a reminder, it's 2-on-2 gameplay. It's tag team fighting game mechanics this time, not 3-on-3, as has been the way for the past couple of years.
Indeed.
Or, sorry, past couple Marvel versus Capcom games.
But speaking of characters that make good statues, Jason Voorhees is one of the iconic characters of horror.
Indeed. So many different poses and images and takes on that character you can put into statue form.
Yeah, I mean, with his machete and hockey mask, it's kind of hard to not know who the character is. Even if you're not really into horror movies, you've seen Jason before. But Jason, you know, as we all know, is the main big bad from the Friday the 13th series. And Friday the 13th, if you recall, a couple of years ago, had a successfully funded Kickstarter game, which actually looked like a really awesome game.
It was a really awesome idea for a take on the Friday the 13th game.
Yes, and it was delayed until 2017, which made a lot of people sad. But, hey, guess what? We're in 2017. Remember that? Remember a few months ago when that happened?
Yeah, blinked and you might have missed it.
Yes, but we're in 2017 now, and the release date for this mythical Friday the 13th game has been dropped. And that release date, drum roll, May 26th for PS4, Xbox One, and PC.
Disappointing that it's not on a Friday the 13th.
Yes, that is a bit disappointing. They could have worked that out a little bit, but it is what it is, and I'm sure people are just glad to finally get their hands on it.
Mm-hmm. It will come out on PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and PC as a digital game.
Yes, I did mention that.
Well, just reinforcing it for people.
For $40 US, so probably
$80 Canadian.
Yeah, some insane price Canadian for a while. But there will apparently be a story mode at some point, but at launch, only the multiplayer will be available, which is probably okay because that was the main thing that we saw they were really pushing was their 1v7 asymmetric multiplayer gameplay, which saw you and six friends, well, you and six of your seven other friends that you're playing with, playing as camp counselors, or you're playing as Jason, playing against seven of your friends who are all camp counselors.
Mm-hmm.
So the mechanic being, of course, if you're Jason, you have to hunt down and kill all your friends. If you're not Jason, you have to survive and not get killed by your friend Jason.
When you put it that way, it sounds so much more morbid and disturbing.
Yes. Or maybe you're not actually friends with the guy who's playing as Jason.
Or maybe you won't be after this.
Maybe.
This is your breakup message to them.
Indeed.
I'm done with you people. Machete through the sternum.
But yes, there's three maps. Those maps being the iconic Camp Crystal Lake, Higgins Haven, and Packanack Lodge.
Which I'm sure there will be, you know, maps later on, added later on down the road.
Yeah, including one that's probably outer space, going all the way up to Jason X.
Jason on a space station. Because, of course.
Hey.
It happened.
It happened. It had a huge ad campaign back in the 90s. I remember. But, yeah. Sometime later this summer, the campaign mode will be added as a free update, which will be cool and a nice thing to keep you playing.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're not still just, you know, having fun with the game, it looked like it would be fun. I'll probably pick it up at some point.
It looks like a bloody good time. Just a silly, over-the-top, just, you know, murder fest.
Yes. But
done with a somewhat lighthearted fashion because it's... There's something always cheesy about Jason Voorhees.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, it helps that a lot of the kills... they had guys like Tom Savini as sort of overseeing and offering opinions on kills and things. And that's one of the great parts about the Friday the 13th series as a whole, on the whole, I should say, is, you know, seeing what kind of ridiculous kills Jason is going to pull off in the movie, you know. And the game looks like it's not going to be, have a shortage of them.
Certainly not, no. And on the one hand, that asymmetric multiplayer aspect is revisiting the idea of the NES game with Jason and the camp counselors, but putting a modern twist on it of what you can do with the technology, really.
Yeah. I'm sure if you could have had everything real time, it would have been pretty close to real time. But of course, with the super restrictions of the NES, you obviously can't do real time or eight players at once all trying to, you know, do things, but we can now. And to quote Jasper from The Simpsons, what a time to be alive.
He was not talking about a Friday the 13th game when he made that quote, but I see your point all the same. But speaking of the horror franchise, Friday the 13th movies have been around for a number of years. And if you look back on some of the older ones, they certainly look hokey and cheesy, and are not threatening or scary or frightening to any degree by this point.
No, because they look like they're obviously like cheesy 90s movies. And cheesy 90s movies, definitely have a certain look to them.
Yes. Especially the ones that are full on 90s, trying to look contemporary in the 90s.
Yeah, making no bones to be timeless at all. Or no attempt to be timeless at all, I should say. That sort of extended itself on occasion to the video game world, because one of the interesting things that happened, I want to say mid-90s, when disc-based games started popping out, were coming out for disc-based systems, like the Sega CD, we would see full motion video for the first time, really, in games. And it was often really low budget, poorly acted, but still full motion video nonetheless.
Indeed. The money went into the technology to make it happen, not necessarily the production of the full motion video itself.
Yes, not necessarily hiring the best actors or, you know, the best editors or really the best people available for film type production values. And we ended up with, you know, kind of cheesy videos. Like, if you remember the Command and Conquer series, some of the videos were cheesy in that series. Other games with full motion video, like the Zork Grand Inquisitor game.
The Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
Demo game, really, for the Sega CD. That was one of the six initial games which came bundled with the Sega CD. But if we think back to full motion video from the 90s, the preeminent game that we think of from that time is Night Trap. That is the most recognizable name from that era because of the controversy that surrounded it at the time. It, alongside such other games as Mortal Kombat 2, are why we now have a rating system on games.
Yeah.
Those were held up actually in U.S. Congress, U.S. Senate, really U.S. government hearings as being too violent, too mature, too whatever for
the youth. Too intense for the youths.
Yes. For the youth of the day, and there had to be a labeling system in order to protect the youth of the day. As happens every so often, I mean, comics were ultimately slapped with, you know, warning labels, rating labels, happened in the 80s with the PMRC and music, and then 90s and video games was just that generation's medium that had to be restricted by old people for the kids.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, that was the history of Night Trap, and Night Trap, that kind of was its contribution to video gaming, and it's really been...
It didn't do well otherwise, really. As a game, it sort of faded into obscurity after sort of just making a little bit of a splash to start with. But then after that, yeah. But it did sort of retain a bit of a cult following because of how ultimately goofy it was as a game where you're just sort of... Like, I never played it. But it's my understanding of what the game was, where you had a bunch of cameras in a, I guess, like a sorority house, and you had to sort of switch cameras and, like, guide people towards where to stop bad people from doing bad things to the co-ed members of the sorority.
Yeah. If it wasn't a sorority house, it was certainly, like, girls sleep overnight at one of their friends' house because the parents are away.
Yeah.
And then bad people or vampires or monsters, just evil entities are trying to get into this specific house, and you as the player are helping guide the action, almost like a choose-your-own-adventure type method or point-and-click, to protect them and unleash traps to defend them against these evildoers.
Yeah.
Really the concept of a really crappy 80s or 90s horror movie, like straight to VHS horror movie.
Yes. So you might be wondering, why are we talking about this? Well, it is sort of celebrating a 25-year anniversary this year, but that's not necessarily why. If anything else, we would talk about it during a Blast from the Past, but we're not. And there's a reason why we're not. Not because it was too crappy of a game. No, but there actually is a Kentucky-based studio called Screaming Villains who announced just the other day that they intend to bring a 25th anniversary re-release of Night Trap to modern consoles, PlayStation 4 and Xbox One, later this year.
Yes, they are. And there's actually a trailer they released heralding this announcement, which we link to on our website, thearcadeshow.com. It's also, we have a link to it. Scroll through our timeline on Twitter. We are at The Arcade Show. Follow us, why don't you? And you can watch the trailer, and it is more violently 90s than the game was violent.
Yeah, it's aggressively 90s. Be prepared to be taken back to a time when Full House was a popular television program. Perhaps you really thought Urkel was cool, or the Stefan version of Urkel was cool. You couldn't just wait for TGIF, and you used the word cowabunga unironically because you were a big fan of the Ninja Turtles.
You wore t-shirts with Fido Dido on them.
Yes. Remember Fido Dido? If you're way too young to remember any of these things, perhaps this game is not for you. Perhaps you didn't have Bugle Boy jeans. Perhaps you don't remember Chip and Pepper. though they might have just been more popular in Canada than they were anywhere else, but these were all aggressively 90s things.
Starter jackets.
Yes.
Starter pullover team jackets.
Team jackets, yes. With those weird V designs.
For the front pocket. The
front pocket, yes.
Yes.
And with their weird neon colors.
Pump up Nike shoes.
Yes. These are all things that are less aggressively 90s than this Nightcap trailer that was released for the 25th anniversary of Nightcap. And full disclosure, I'm probably going to buy this game. I'm going to spend money on this.
Wow. If I recall back in the day, I'm pretty sure that because we had a Sega CD in my household back in the day, for reasons I've never been made clear on, we just did. It was a thing that came into our house, and I was not going to question it because I was young and video games, new device, woo! And disc-based games were kind of ahead of their time back then, especially the Sega CD.
Oh, yeah.
And full-motion video games were ahead of their time back then, especially the Sega CD.
Yeah, I mean, the Sega CD had its share of them, like Street Shark.
Oh, yes.
It was another one.
Sewer Shark.
Sewer Shark, not Street Shark. That was a crappy, aggressively 90s cartoon show.
Yes, a knockoff of the popularity of the Turtles.
Yes.
When everything was anthropomorphized animals.
Yes.
Sorry, aggressive anthropomorphized animals.
Yes. Like the Ninja Turtles, the Biker Mice from Mars, the Street Sharks.
Cowboys of Moon Mesa.
Yep. But yes, all of those things. Sewer Shark had full motion video, mm-hmm. and it was also, well, not a great game, but...
No.
I mean... Still a notable thing. Another one in the pantheon of Nightcap-esque games, but go on.
As I was going to say, Nightcap was one of those games where we'd see on the shelf and I'd be intrigued by, because I think I had an awareness of it at the time and just reading or scanning through the articles in GamePro or EGM or Tips and Tricks back in the day of what was going on with it. And that always made me curious to play it, but I ultimately never got the chance to because I was just too young, and that wasn't a game that would be rented for my sister and I to play over a weekend. But this would afford me an opportunity to that I didn't have back then to see what all the fuss was about. I mean, on the one hand, I'm intrigued to see what all the fuss was about, but the other hand, I know I'm going to be underwhelmed.
It's going to be a bad game.
By what all the fuss was about.
I'm fully accepting of that. I'm still going to buy it because I never had a Sega. I never was a Sega person, but I always wanted to play Nightcap. I didn't ever know anyone that had it. It wouldn't make sense for me to rent it because where am I going to take a Sega CD game to?
Yeah, if you don't have the system.
If I don't have the system and if I know certain friends' parents wouldn't let them play certain games, like that wouldn't make... I don't want to be the bad influence friend.
Save that for the teen years.
Yes. Of course. But,
so this will afford an opportunity that many of us didn't have back then because we just weren't of an age to understand what the hell was going on.
Yeah, and it was too much of a flash in the pan. It didn't have any sort of lasting appeal. It didn't spawn any sequels.
Oh, certainly not.
The developers kind of didn't really make another Nightcap type game, to my knowledge, again, at least that had the same fanfare that Nightcap briefly had. So yeah.
And it is regarded more so for its contribution to the rating system we now have for video games than for being a good game, which should tell you all you need to know. I mean, Mortal Kombat 2, as I said at the start, was held up as also one of those reasons. Well, Mortal Kombat and Mortal Kombat 2, because they came out a year apart, as being reasons that a rating system on games were necessary because they were just too violent and the content was not appropriate for children.
Yes, even though looking back, if you look at the graphics and everything of that game now, it's really tame and silly. Any bones and guts you see, anytime a person explodes into blood and bones, you see like 10 femurs on the ground. Like that's... It's insane. It's not realistic. It's cartoonish.
It is. Likely, I'd say in the case of Mortal Kombat, it's just the fact that on the Sega version, there'd be blood. You know, blood would be knocked out of the opponents, whereas wouldn't be on the Super Nintendo version, and that'd be too much for kids.
Well, in the Super Nintendo version of 2 and 3, there was blood.
Well, not the first one, though.
It's true.
So it made Sega better.
For a brief period of time.
You have the Sega and its people to thank for the rating system on games, even though, actually, Sega tried to be proactive and institute their own rating system on games.
It's true. Sega was actually really ahead of its time. Gotta tip your hat to Sega. For as badly as they eventually failed, they did some crazy things and took some insane risks that no other company did.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, disc-based games, the Sega Channel. The Sega Channel was insane.
Yep. Sega Channel was online gaming before there was online gaming.
Like, at least 10 years before there was online gaming. Like, it was, as robust as it was fast, you could get games online, it was Netflix 15 years before there was Netflix. I mean, for video games. But, yeah, I remember playing Sega Channel and being blown away by how insane it was.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all just Sega. I mean, so you can give Sega crap, but hey, they...
And Sega deserves crap for many choices it's made in its history, but at other points, especially in the early years of the 16-bit wars, it was there and it made some interesting decisions and some proactive and progressive ones. And like I said, they had a rating system on their games before they were forced to, before Nintendo had. And then eventually the ESRB was formed basically as a forced to. From U.S. Government offices, and and now we have the rating system we do on games, so make of that what you will, but Night Trap, you can experience the game that helped start it all and see what the fuss was about later this year. We will let you know an official release date once that information gets released. But one last news item we want to get to on this week's show. Speaking of things from yesteryear, as we live in an ever-increasingly electronic-based society.
And also an ever-increasingly nostalgia-based society.
Mm-hmm. This is kind of an interesting little crossroads between them. The announcement this week, kind of a surprise announcement, that the next expansion pack for Forza Horizon 3 is not just going to bring some, you know, fancy new exotic cars into the world, like a new Aston Martin or a new Lotus or a new Porsche to the world, or bring some exotic locales like Monaco or whatever else into the world. No. It's going to go in the opposite direction of that.
Yes. Think smaller.
Think sillier.
Yes. Think loop-de-loopier.
Think bright orange.
Yes. That, of course, can only mean, it could mean a few things, but specifically what it means is Hot Wheels. Yes.
Hot Wheels leading the way.
Yes. But Horizon 3 is releasing a Hot Wheels expansion, which brings Hot Wheels cars and tracks to the game, which also brings arcade-style gameplay to the game, because Forza 3 is not necessarily an arcade-style game.
No, it tries to be a more realistic racer.
Yeah, but the Hot Wheels expansion makes it a lot sillier. Makes it a lot more like a 90s arcade type game.
Oh, yeah. Imagine, you know, like a Micro Machines, but more modern.
But slightly bigger, but not too much bigger.
No. So with this expansion, players will be able to visit six themed islands off the coast of Australia, each of which are connected by Hot Wheels tracks that will consist of the standard configurations you'd expect to see with anything Hot Wheels related, like loops, corkscrews.
Those booster things where your car would drive through and just suddenly speed up.
Or the booster wheel things. Yeah. To go over big jumps or whatnot too.
Yeah. Oh, the jumps are probably going to be crazy.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's boost pads, half pipes, big jumps.
And I think most interestingly, even though there's going to be set tracks, there's going to be stunt sections, as well as a feature called Stunt Swap, which will allow you to modify these stunt track sections with other interchangeable stunt track parts, just like you would be able to do with a real Hot Wheels track.
Which is awesome.
It is awesome. And I'm glad that we have the technology to do this now. It's just what video games needed. More technology to do stupider things.
There's an element of truth to that. The crazier aspect amongst all of this is, if you think back to some Hot Wheels sets you maybe had back in the day or what you've seen now, is that there's usually some set where the cars will kind of race around, go through loops, jumps or whatever, and there's like some big creature at the end of it that's just trying to get your car, be it a shark that's trying to chomp down on things, be it a giant robot, or, as has been in some sets, a giant dinosaur. Apparently the giant dinosaur is going to be in this expansion at the end of a track trying to chomp your car.
Awesome.
Except it's a giant realistic looking dinosaur because it's the Forza 3 engine.
Yes.
Or sorry, Forza Horizon 3 engine.
Yes. Game engine.
Game engine.
Not car engine.
Well, not yet.
Not yet.
So there's about 9 or 10 cars that are included in this expansion. Most notably among them, the 1969 Hot Wheels twin mill car, which is the classic one with, you know, basically two engines on each front wheel.
Yep.
Which is crazy. The 2011 Bone Shaker, the 2012 Rip Rod, as well as a 2016 Jeep Trailcat, 2010 Pagani Zonda R, hell, even the 2016 Zenvo ST1, if these things mean anything to you.
Or a 72 Chrysler VH Valiant Charger.
Yes, and the 2007 Toyota Hilux Arctic Truck, AT38, amongst others.
Yeah.
But that if any of those mean anything to you, then you are a Hot Wheels devotee, and you will want to check this out. It comes out May 9th, for Forza Horizon 3. It is included in the expansion pass that comes with Blizzard Mountain. So that Blizzard Mountain plus Hot Wheels pass is $35, or just the Hot Wheels pass itself is $20. All U.S. funds I'm speaking of there. And I recommend checking out the trailer because the action shows is crazy and actually looks really fun for bringing just a silly over-the-top arcade racing element to Forza Horizon 3. Not only that, the cars look gorgeous, obviously. The tracks look hilarious and fun, but also the soundtrack. I mean, it's only, you know, a 90-second trailer video, but it's set actually to the song Riders in the Sky as covered by Me First and the Gimme Gimmes. And
interesting.
Yeah. Everyone needs a little Me First and the Gimme Gimmes in their life.
It's true.
It's been too long. If you're hearing that and you're thinking, oh yeah, I should listen to them again, you should do that.
Or if you've never even heard of them, come on.
Yes.
I mean, they've come up with some pretty okay albums. Not gonna lie, I'm not a huge punk guy, but gotta like some Me First and the Gimme Gimmes. They do some great covers.
Ruin Johnny's Bar Mitzvah?
I mean, hilarious. That is a great album.
Hilarious.
I was going to say, I couldn't remember what the kid's name was. I was like, the Ruin the Kids Bar Mitzvah album was great.
Where they literally take a break to go to the ice cream bar.
Oh, man.
So check it out for that reason. Honestly, when I heard the song, I had to look it up. Watch the trailer and heard the song. I had to look it up. Like, who the hell was that? Because it's a really fast-paced, hard-driving, energy song. And I liked it. I wanted to know more about it and found out, hey, that's Me First and the Gimme Gimmes. That was on their country album? I need to listen to Me First and the Gimme Gimmes. It's been too long.
Yes.
I need that album. So, I am now listening to Me First and the Gimme Gimmes.
Yes.
Love Their Country, which is all their country covers album.
Yes. Back on the Me First and Gimme Gimmes train, I see.
It's been a good train to be on.
Been what, like 10 years?
Yes.
They've also been around for a long time. But speaking of things that have been around for a long time, usually the things, us, as well as things from, you know, that we like to draw from for our Blast from the Past segment, which is our final segment in every program, where we like to kind of take you down a stroll of memory lane.
Holding your hand. As the sun is setting.
Telling you about something that you should check out or try that is celebrating some notable anniversary. This week, it's something that's celebrating a surprising anniversary to me.
Because it doesn't feel like it's as old as it is.
Yes, because I definitely remember seeing these movies, like, in the theater when they were new. And it still doesn't feel like, yeah, it's crazy. This movie is 20 years old.
It released, officially released on May 2nd, 1997. So yes, turning 20 years old, depending on when you listen to this, either is or will be turning or has turned 20 years old as of May 2nd. This is a movie, as Dennis said, he saw it in the theaters. I distinctly recall seeing it in the theaters. I distinctly recall talking to my friend on the phone at the time, trying to convince him to go see it with me. He was apprehensive at the time because it was not set in contemporary time. It was not set in 1997. Well, parts of it were not set in 1997, and he was afraid he wouldn't get the references to the previous era. I had to assure him that whatever he didn't get, I would fill him in on. I, apparently being a more well-rounded and knowledgeable individual of the world than he was.
He was not talking to me. This, I was not that friend.
No, no, no. Different friends at that point, but nevertheless, eventually, yes, did convince him enough to go see it. And this movie we're speaking of is set in two time frames, is set in 1997, but also takes place 30 years prior in 1967. It is Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery, the first Austin Powers movie.
Yes.
It's 20 years old.
When this movie came out, I watched it so many times. I think this was one of like the first movies I specifically made an effort to like get on VHS to be like, okay, I have to watch this movie several times. A few of my siblings also watched it several times as well. This movie was hilarious. I loved this movie when it came out. And it was sort of starting to make it look like Mike Myers was a man that was able to just kind of make comedy franchises that were successful across more than one movie. It was just he was a great character creator.
He was. He created, Wayne and Garth, in the Wayne's World, well, segment on SNL and then the Wayne's World movies. Took a couple years off. He did have the movie So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Yeah, but people were kind of wondering if he's going to do a third Wayne's World movie. No, he ended up making this movie, and then it was super successful, and then he ended up making it into a whole film franchise. And then after that, Shrek.
Which was another even more successful.
Franchise. I mean, but like, if you want to see the genius of Mike Myers before he was sort of like super overexposed, this is a great entry point into that.
Yes. It is enough of Mike Myers and his creativity, but he doesn't go too far with it.
Yeah.
Doesn't go off the deep end or anything.
He doesn't do a Love Guru or
no.
Anything dumb like that.
The film is set in the 60s. It stars Mike Myers as the titular Austin Powers, a setup of 60s British spy genre, really.
Yeah. But it's also a fish out of water story because he's cryogenically frozen and brought back to defeat an evil genius from the 60s during the 90s. And there's a lot of like funny, like man out of time kind of missteps. Like he's from the 60s. They're both from the 60s. So they're trying to like come to grips with how this weird, crazy world of the 90s now.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both somehow managing, despite the fact that it seems like neither one should be, and they both kind of come off feeling like old men, even though they're not really old men. Well, Dr. Evil sort of is, but yeah. I mean, I don't know what there is to say about this that hasn't been said. It's great.
It is great.
I feel like it still holds up.
For the most part, I mean, the 60s segments certainly hold up because they're not trying to be, you know, of a contemporary time.
Yeah.
You know, the 90s world as he comes into it later in the film. Well, yes, because that's modern for that time, but, you know.
It's a little bit retro now.
It is retro, certainly retro now, but it's 20 years retro. So now it's got that certain, you know, kitsch and charm to it.
But like a great cast in this movie. I mean, besides Mike Myers, you know, as both the protagonist and the antagonist, of Austin Powers and Dr. Evil.
Yes, his, you know, trying to do his turn as like a Peter Sellers, who playing multiple roles in one movie.
Yeah. You know, also Elizabeth Hurley as Vanessa Kensington.
Yes, his, you know, comely young lass as, you know, assistant, co-agent, as so often was the case in, say, the James Bond movies. Well, all the James Bond movies, really.
Yeah. Seth Green making his first appearance as Scott Evil and really, like, cementing himself sort of in popular culture as this guy is actually pretty funny.
That's one of the funny aspects of the movie is the dynamic between Dr. Evil and his son, Scott.
Yeah. And then, you know, other characters who were popular at the time, a lot of them who are still popular now, like Will Ferrell.
Yes, the henchman who will never die.
Yes. And then just also some, like, interesting cameos of, like, unfortunately, actually, a lot of people who are no longer with us, like Charles Napier, who was brilliant in this movie.
Yes.
Carrie Fisher made a cameo as a therapist. Well, Burt Bacharach was in there. I don't think he's dead.
I don't keep up with him.
Other people, you know, other... Maybe not as top of mind, but you'd probably know them if you saw them.
Tom Arnold.
Clint Howard.
yes.
Michael McDonald. Remember him? The comedian?
Yes.
Or from Mad TV?
Yes.
He was the guy who was in that stupid scene with the steamroller. Hey, that's all I need to say about that one scene. Christian Slater was a guard in this movie, which is kind of awesome to look back and go, oh, that's Christian Slater.
Yes, I think he and Rob Lowe were in deleted scenes.
Yep, Rob Lowe was in deleted scenes as well.
But Rob Lowe coming back in the second Austin Powers.
Oh, yes.
As young number two.
Yes. Oh, man. The dynamic that Mike Myers has with Rob Lowe is fantastic. I'm glad that he carried it forward from Wayne's World.
I think there needs to be another, like, movie with the two of them in it.
Yes. Both as older men that, well, one of them ages. The other one doesn't. But yeah, it's a fantastic movie, and,
this is one of those movies I found, where after its release, there was a similar thing that happened to it as, say, what happened with, or after the release of Ace Ventura, or The Mask, where it had so many quotable catchphrases that it just kind of became, those were things you'd hear everywhere.
Yeah.
Your parents, on the news.
And even, it got annoying for a while, and it got really kind of to the point where it's like, oh, I'm so done with this stupid Austin Powers thing. Then the second movie came out, and it was like, oh God, this is still funny. And then the third movie, and it was still funny.
Oh, I love the third movie.
Like, I liked all three of them. I saw them all in the theater. I think I might have even seen the second one a couple times in the theater.
That's okay. Nothing wrong with that.
But, yeah, I mean, they were the kind of things that were everywhere. Like, pop culture was just oozing with Austin Powers quotes and references and stuff, and it was a bit overwhelming for a while.
It was. Hell, even Austin Powers was a really popular Halloween costume for a number of years.
Yeah. But, you know, 20 years out, and definitely after the hype has died down, I think it's worth going back and checking it out again. Like, it's
entirely possible you've just kind of put it out of your mind because it was such a big deal back then, especially as it became a franchise with subsequent movies, that you may have just tried to, well, for your own sanity, turn it down or tune it out a little bit, but go back and revisit it. And I think what really made, especially the first film, work so well is that the 60s scenes that are homage and love letter to 60s British spy movies that I believe Mike Myers said he wrote kind of as a love letter to...
Like James Bond.
To James Bond, and also the films he'd watch with his father.
Yeah.
Peter Sellers movies or Sean Connery movies with him as James Bond. Those scenes from the 60s, they're spot on in what they are parodying. Yeah. And there's so many references and homages to the first number of James Bond movies or the Avengers TV series, the British spy series and not Marvel.
Not some Marvel thing, no.
No. To name a few and probably a few Peter Sellers Pink Panther references in there as well.
Yeah. It's also worth noting, interestingly, that George Clinton did the soundtrack for this movie.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that.
I didn't know that either until I just looked over at this, at the Wikipedia page, and I saw George S. Clinton. It's like, huh. Interesting.
Interesting indeed. Also, this movie, really brought back, Soul Bossa Nova from Quincy Jones into a lot of prominence. The, what you would think of as the Austin Powers theme, you know, kind of plays really at the start, but that's the,
Oh, it's a different George Clinton, by the way. It's not the Parliament George Clinton. That's fine. Still a good name.
Very well. But yes, Quincy Jones with Soul Bossa Nova being included in the film, and associated that much with the character, hell, used in big dance sequences in the movie as well.
Like that, every time you hear that move, that song now, you think, oh, that's the Austin Powers song.
Exactly. But that was a song Quincy Jones composed in the 70s, I think it was, if not earlier. And
62.
Holy crap.
But,
very much of the time and appropriate then.
Yeah.
And also, this film intercutting, transitions with just random moments of
just dance sequences.
Dance sequences, Austin Powers just jumping around, or Austin Powers playing with a band, but it's really just Mike Myers and friends playing in a band they had called Ming T. And yes, they actually have a song in the film that would play during the credits and also appeared on the soundtrack called BBC, which is a very simple song and is really just listing off the different number of BBC channels. There's a lot of BBC channels.
Yes.
But that's the joke. And it's Mike Myers on vocals.
Yes.
As Austin Powers.
Yes, it is.
But... again, crazy to think that it's 20 years old, came out officially on May 2nd, 1997, went on to spawn, two sequels, Austin Powers and the Spy Who Shagged Me, and then Austin Powers in Goldmember, and, a trilogy is great, but this also seemed like a franchise that could just keep going, like the James Bond movies.
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting if they picked it up now. Like, unlike Wayne's World, I feel like Austin Powers could actually be picked up now and still sort of work.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if he's like an older Austin Powers passing the torch to some other younger cryogenically frozen, similar.
Cryogenically frozen from the 80s.
Yeah, or something like that.
And has to acclimate them to the world as it exists now?
Yes.
Which would be an even tougher challenge given the technological advances.
That is true, but,
So yes, you've seen it, you've likely seen it on theaters, you may have the VHS or DVD kicking around somewhere, it has been on TV countless times.
You'll be able to get it somewhere.
Yes.
We'll just leave it at that.
But you certainly should check it out, watch it again, it is still funny. It is safe to say that it is still funny, and, I think has aged pretty well, for the most part.
Yeah, I think so. It has actually been a few years since I've seen it last, but I saw it somewhat recently, and it felt like it was still pretty good.
Well, there you go. That's a ringing endorsement, if ever I've heard it.
Yes. Maybe I'll watch it soon and report back.
Excellent. You do that, and the rest of you out there do that as well, and we want to hear your thoughts on Austin Powers. International Man of Mystery, the first one. Do you enjoy it as much now as you did then? Does it hold up? Are you put off by it? Does it not live up to what your memories of it were? Let us know. Email us info@thearcadeshow.com or send us a message and follow us on Twitter @thearcadeshow, and also send us a message and like our page on Facebook, facebook.com/thearcadeshow. Those are the ways in which you can get a hold of us. As well, you can also subscribe to this program and get it delivered straight to your digital doorstep every week when we release a new episode. We are on iTunes and the Google Play Store, in the podcast section of the Google Play Store, I should say. Find links to everything easily on our website, thearcadeshow.com. So I'd say that about wraps us up for this week. So until next week, everybody, good night.
Good night.